Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay. We've had some downers of shows for the past few weeks. Look, obviously the lockdown has been not a pleasant place to live, given everything that's happening on the planet. So we decided this episode to do something slightly off the wall and a little bit atypical for us, but it's your idea, Frank, so why don't you introduce it?
Yes, thanks, David. So David and I were having a chat earlier in the week, and I thought for this episode, we could come up with, if we were coming up with a Hall of Fame, like the Baseball Hall of Fame, of historians, who would we put in it? And the crisis. So
that's
going to
get a lot
today,
of visitors, Frank, the baseball. Yeah, it will. Historians Hall of Fame.
Yes, exactly. And I decided, so the premise of our discussion today, we've each been allowed to pick five historians, and they have to consider our period. So Dave, you know, my period is I consider it the Revolution and Early Republic period in American history, broadly conceived. And David, of course, works on the Civil War and Reconstruction, the middle period in American history, as it's sometimes called. The historians in question, in terms of criteria, are deceased, I think in part because we didn't want to choose between our living colleagues and friends. And secondly, that's the way of these halls of fame. We want to consider people's careers in their totality. And so these are deceased historians, and we're looking at their overall career contribution. So these are not necessarily people who wrote the best books in our fields, although there will be some overlap there, I think. So that's what I had in mind. Dave, do you have anything to add in terms of the criteria?
I had several criteria. And because coming up with this list was really hard. I mean, when you proposed this, they're like, that sounds great. And then I had a list of like 20 names, and then I said, oh, this is, you know. So I tried very hard to figure out like what were some good criteria to include. So the dead one is tricky, because there are lots of very productive historians who live a very long time. Bernard Balin's like, he seems like he's 120. He's actually in his 90s, I guess, you know, but hugely productive over a very long period of time.
And not on the list today because he's still alive, as
at least as time of recording, right? And, you know, there's lots of people who I said, they're still alive. So that was a tricky one. I didn't want to pick sort of one hit wonders, people who had done something important, but really only had done one thing that was important. I want somebody who had sort of some kind of diversity over the period of their career, done sort of multiple things of note. I wanted historians. My sort of third criteria was people who were both respected inside and outside of academia. So I wanted historians that people actually read and had sort of an impact beyond the sort of historian community. I didn't want to make it like the rock star that no one listens to, but is the person all the rock stars listen to. I didn't want any of those people. I just wanted people who had some respect both in both sort of sets of the reading community. I wanted people who had some kind of lasting impact on the field, and people who had who are sort of still worth reading now, potentially, and had shaped the field in some other way, producing lots of PhD students. Fifth criteria, I didn't want any jerks on my list because I figured there's only five, and I wanted to have people that didn't have to be angels or perfect people, but I was excluding people who were accused of plagiarism, other kinds of professional malfeasance, people who were overtly racist, which, when you're talking about mid-19th century stuff, that actually excludes a decent number of folks.
Yeah, my list is problematic.
I figured I could, you know, there's lots of important scholarship, but it's, I didn't want to, but, you know, there's enough people who aren't racist, or at least are, where racism isn't sort of the point of their scholarship. And the sixth criteria I used was I wanted to pick people I'd read enough of where I could speak intelligently about them. I think there's some people who I know are really important, like Alan Nevins was on my list for a while, but then I realized I hadn't read enough Alan Nevins to sort of articulate why he's important. So there's some people who are not on the list that maybe should be, but that's...
Oh, that's a great idea for a future episode, David. We could come up with a list of great historians we haven't read.
Yes, because, I mean, there's lots of guys who I've read some of and people who I've read bits, but I didn't want to sort of... So that's sort of an arbitrary criteria, but this is our show, so whatever. Right, and so I think we're going to, instead of trying to, like, rank them, I think that's tricky because I want to compare them, but maybe do them in the chronological order. Is that a good way to sort of give our top five, Frank?
Sure. So date of birth, earliest date of birth, we'll go from sort of oldest to the closest to the present. Is that correct?
That sounds like a plan. Let's do that.
Okay, good. Yeah, that sounds excellent. The other thing, and I think we should, you know, it's our show, we can do what we want. I think one thing that we should consider, David, is I've thought of people in broad categories that I tried to consider, and I'll elaborate on those as I go. But it's almost more interesting to consider the people I didn't select. You know, so to some extent, these come in pairs because I think, well, I included so-and-so, but I excluded, you know, such and such because of that. But, you know, it was a close-run thing in a lot of these.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. This was not an easy task.
That was fun though. Yes. I did enjoy it.
And I've got we have not compared lists. So in the off chance that we have somebody on both of our lists, I've got a backup name.
But I suspect that's not going to happen. Based on, you know, I did hew pretty close to the Revolution throughout and early National.
All right. So who's your earliest pick?
Yes, so I think my earliest pick, it will be the earliest pick of the show. It is Mercy Otis Warren, born in 1728, died 1814, born in, and lived mainly in what is now Plymouth County, Massachusetts. Mercy Warren was one of the earliest historians of the American Revolution. She published a three-volume history. What she's most famous for, a three-volume history of the Revolution called The History of the Rise, Progress, and Termination of the American Revolution that appeared in 1805. She's a fascinating woman. She was very, very active politically, very, very well connected in Massachusetts.
Yeah, she knew all the people she was writing about.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I selected her in terms of her methodology. So she was the sister of James Otis, who was one of the very first people to offer a critique of British rule in the 1760s in Massachusetts. She was the wife of James Warren, who was a leader of the Patriot movement in the colony. But she was a political thinker and activist in her own right. She knew the Adamses very well, and we'll talk about that in a second probably. She was also a very, very prolific writer. She was a poet. She wrote a number of poems. She wrote a number of plays, which aren't very good. In 1788, she wrote a pamphlet called Observations on the New Constitution. It was an anti-Federalist pamphlet. She published it anonymously, in part because of her gender, but it was a critique of the Constitution. In 1790, she began publishing relatively late in her life at this point. She was in her early 60s. She published a collection of poems and plays under her own name, culminating in her kind of writing life, culminated in her writing The History of the Revolution in 1805. Now, the history itself is interesting. I encountered it in graduate school for the first time, and I teach it to this day to students, although I don't think they always appreciate my assigning it. It's tough going in places. It's very long. It's written in that 18th century style of history, which is to say you begin with your sort of the first settlement of the colonies in order to tell the history of the Revolution. So it's very long in detail, but as you said, she knew a lot of the people involved in the Revolution and corresponded with them. She corresponded with Jefferson. She knew John Adams well. She knew Abigail Adams well. They didn't get along necessarily well after she published her history, because her History of the Revolution is very critical of the Federalists, including of John Adams, and she had some biting things to say about Adams. One reason why I think the book is significant is because it prompted a long kind of correspondence between Warren and Adams over its content. And then subsequently, Adams in his retirement after Warren died, she died in 1814, Adams, who could never let anything go, wrote a number of long essays for the Boston Patriot, a newspaper in 1819, I believe, kind of critiquing her interpretation. So she used as primary sources, she had access to oral history, and we have very little of this from the Revolutionary era. I also chose her because I think she's representative of that first generation of American historians. She's not alone. There were a number of other individuals who wrote histories, the early histories of the Revolution. I'm thinking of David Ramsey, who was a Revolutionary War veteran in South Carolina, who wrote a history. I almost included John Marshall for his biography of his big five-volume biography of George Washington instead of Warren, because that's another kind of landmark history of the age. But I opted for Warren instead. So okay. Mercy Otis Warren is my first nomination.
Because I mean, one of the things that strikes me, and this is something I struggled with in coming up with my list, is you know, she's lots of things. Historians, one of the things that she did. But you know, she clearly was, you know, historian as a profession, where it, you know, really emerges in the late 19th century as a sort of career track with professional training and all of that. So she's a, you know, as you point out, she's a playwright. She does all these other things. So she's multifaceted, like lots of people from her generation.
That's right. And did not make a living as an historian.
Right.
She was not a professional in that sense. So. Who's your first, David?
All right, so my earliest, it's a whole lot later than yours, it's C. Van Woodward.
Excellent,
yeah. Who was born in 1908, he dies in 1999. He got his PhD at UNC Chapel Hill, which is not a bad school, writing about Tom Watson, the populist leader from the end of the 19th century. But shortly after that, he's in the Navy. He becomes a historian for the Navy. He writes these histories of major battles that the Navy is in during the Second World War. But it's really in the 1950s and onwards that he really sort of makes his mark in the historical profession. There's two really big, important books in the 50s. The Origins of the New South, which is published in 1951, which ended up winning the Bancroft Prize, which is about the period after Reconstruction. A really phenomenally important book in terms of the scholarship on the late 19th century South, a book that's still worth reading, a book that people are still engaging with. And the other book, which is a much shorter book, much less likely to hurt you if you throw it at somebody, is The Strange Career of Jim Crow, which I know you've assigned on occasion, Frank, which is published in 1955. Which is a really important book on the origins of segregation. He argues that segregation wasn't something that was deeply embedded in Southern culture, but something that actually emerged relatively late was a result of legal processes in the 1890s, and therefore could be deconstructed much in the same way it was constructed. It was based on a series of lectures he gave, but it was called, Martin Luther King called it, the historical Bible for the civil rights movement. It's a part of the reason why I'm picking Woodward, is he's somebody who is, you know, clearly influential in the historical profession, but is also having an impact on the world outside of the historical profession. He ended up teaching mostly at Johns Hopkins and at Yale. He has a huge number of important graduate students. He was James McPherson's doctoral supervisor, Patricia Limerick, Stephen Hahn, a whole bunch of other people. So, you know, he trained a whole generation of historians that are you know, now all very senior people. He ends up winning his sort of last major book. He wins the Pulitzer Prize in 1982 for the Mary Chestnut Civil War. Mary Chestnut was a South Carolina woman who wrote a very famous diary, and he publishes this annotated edition of her diary and wins the Pulitzer Prize for it. So he's able to write in sort of several different modes, writing, you know, Strange Career, which is a very short book intended for a mass audience. Writes the big historical monograph and does an editing job. So I think he's doing a little bit of everything. So that's why I put him on the list.
Excellent. And he was also the editor of the Oxford History of the United States.
Yes.
The original editor, right?
Yes. And he was like, he also, you know, does get involved in lots of sort of public facing things. Like, for instance, after Watergate, Congress appoints a committee of historians to go and look at how presidents have responded to charges of misconduct. Obviously, that didn't work out so well in the long run. But, you know, he is somebody who was recognized, you know, beyond the academy as being an intellectual of merit. So, yeah, he's my earliest chronological pick.
Excellent.
All right, what's your next pick, which is also
my next is
still a lot older than my next pick.
Still a lot older than yours. Born in 1838, died in 1918, Henry Adams.
Oh, wow, okay.
Henry Adams is the great-grandson of John Adams, the grandson of John Quincy Adams, the son of Charles Francis Adams, who, as you well know, was the American ambassador in London during the Civil War. Henry Adams was a very interesting man. I mean, he's known today mainly for his autobiography, The Education of Henry Adams, but he was a very, very prolific and interesting historian. He makes my list for his 9-volume History of the United States during the administrations of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Don't let the title fool you, because the title sounds rather dry and dull. This
and the
is
fact
a,
that it's 9 volumes also
yes.
is a bit of a daunting.
Okay. However, the Library of America has a 2-volume edition that's complete. So the modern edition is 2 long volumes, but and I can't recommend them highly enough. Our former colleague Owen Dudley Edwards describes the Adams's history as the greatest history ever written by somebody born in the United States. I don't know whether I would go that far, but that's just to give you some sense of what some people think of these volumes. They're very, very – the reason he's on the list is well, I've got multiple reasons. First of all, he's a brilliant prose stylist. I mean, he's a really, really beautiful writer. He's also – and so the first 5 chapters of the first volume, when he describes America in 1800 – right before the election of 1800, are phenomenal. I mean, some historians have taken some exception to those. His characterization of America then is kind of remote and rude, but it's really, really phenomenal stuff. He did extensive archival work. Like many in his family, he was very, very well traveled. He was multilingual, so he did archival work in France, Britain, and Spain primarily to write these volumes. So he's adopted quite a trans and international view, which we now, of course, is fashionable, but was not fashionable for a long time in writing about early America. So his account of the negotiations over the Louisiana Purchase, for example, has really – I'm not sure there's anything better in English on it in terms of the level of detail and analysis. So it stood the test of time. It's important. He was originally appointed – he had a very interesting life. He studied at Harvard, of course, as all the Adamses do or did, and went to – and then during the Civil War, he was his father's secretary in London mainly. In 1870, he returns to the United States to become professor of medieval history at Harvard. Huh. And it's very interesting because – and he studied at Berlin – he did graduate work in Berlin. He was trained as a medievalist initially.
And this is like basically when like graduate training starts.
Exactly. This is another reason why he's important. He's credited with offering the first seminars, so teaching by seminar in history in the United States in his course on medieval history at Harvard. So he's important pedagogically, and he's important in this transitional moment. I often think of him alongside of Francis Parkman as these kind of great narrative historians of the 19th century, but where from New England. But whereas Parkman was a professor of botany at Harvard, Adams was actually one of that very first generation of, if you will, professionally trained historians, European trained, came back and applied his skills towards both medieval history. He never lost his interest in that, and the early history of the United States, and a quite important figure. His As I said, his history of the Jefferson and Madison administration still rewards reading. I have a slight caveat because, like many elite WASPs of the late 19th century, his racial views, particularly with regard to anti-Semitism, are not great. So there's a slight qualification there, so it gives me slight pause. Parkman's problematic when it comes to Native Americans, of course. So he's a major, major figure. So he is my second nominee for this fictional historical Hall of Fame.
Okay, good.
He did. Sorry, David. With regard to your period, he wrote a biography of his close friend John Hay.
Oh, okay.
Who's a major figure
close eyewitness source of things, yes.
Yes. But anyway. Yes, so who's your number two?
My number two is John Hope Franklin.
Excellent.
Born in 1915 in Oklahoma, died in 2009 in Durham, North Carolina. He's probably the most important African-American historian in the 20th century. I think that's probably a fair statement. He grew up in segregation, of course, but ends up going to Harvard for graduate school. His father was a survivor of the Tulsa race riot that we've talked about in previous episodes.
They
recently uncovered an account by him of the race riot. So, and Franklin was just John Hope was born just a couple years before that. His first book, which was based on his doctoral dissertation, was The Free Negro in North Carolina. And there's a great story about him writing that the dissertation that became the book. Because one of the sort of phenomenal things about his career was he was able to write about the American South in the context of while the South was still segregated. So when he was working on his dissertation, he writes a letter from Boston or from Cambridge to the North Carolina Archive saying, "Hi, my name is John Hope Franklin. I'm a PhD student here at Harvard. I'd like to come down to use the archives because I'm looking at free African Americans in North Carolina in the early 19th century." And the archivist says, "Great, come on down. We're excited to have, you know, doctoral students come, and especially from such places like Harvard." He comes down to North Carolina to go visit the archives, and the archivist, because he hadn't identified in the letter, didn't realize that Franklin was black. And he says, "Well, you can't come into our research room." And I said, "Well, I've got this letter where you invited me to come down here. I've spent all this money to do this." And the archivist says, "Well, come back tomorrow and we'll figure something out." He comes back and they've set him up in a separate room where he's got his own sort of desk and you know, waste bin and what have you, separate from the main research room in the archives because they didn't want to integrate the research room, obviously, at the sort of apex of segregation. And he tells Franklin, "Look, our usual procedure is you go and you ask at the desk for collections. The guy goes and gets the collections for you. As it happens in almost every archive to this day, right?" He says, "We can't have you do that because all the people who work at the desks are white. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you a key to the archives. You just need to go back into the stacks and get your own stuff." This happens for a period of time, and then the archivists come back and say, "Mr. Franklin, I'm going to ask for your key back." And Franklin's like, "Did I do something wrong?" And the guy says, "No. Just all the white patrons are upset that you get to go back into the stacks and they don't." And so it's one of these really great places where sort of the logic of segregation sort of flips on itself. And so then he actually had to have the same treatment as all the white people because they white people thought he was getting better access than they were. But I think that sort of speaks to the sort of issues that sort of he had really throughout his career. You know, he was a prominent member of the Southern Historical Association, which has its annual conference, and the annual conferences were often in segregated hotels, you know, where he could not stay at the conference hotel, you know. And so those kinds of struggles are really prominent throughout his career. He's probably of He writes a whole series of books. He's probably best known from Slavery to Freedom, which publishes its first edition in 1947, which is really the Bible of, you know, the main sort of text for African-American history. During the 1950s, he is consulted by Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP as part of the lead up to Brown versus Board of Education. So he is really throughout his life working not only as a historian, but as a civil rights activist. He teaches in a number of places. He teaches NC Central, at Howard, at Brooklyn College, where he becomes the first African American to chair a history department in a predominantly white university. He's at the University of Chicago for a long period of time, and then he ends his career at Duke. President Clinton appointed him to a National Committee on Race, where he was the chair of that, and he gets the Presidential Medal of Freedom near the end of his life. And he also writes a really great autobiography. I mean, there's not that many good autobiographies by historians, I don't think. But Franklin's is really, really interesting. It's called Mirror to America, which he wrote really just in the few years before he died. So yeah, my second pick is John Hope Franklin.
That's an excellent pick. Excellent pick. Of course, I mean, I don't want to make light of the circumstances, of course not, but you're right about the kind of paradoxes of segregation, in the sense that what he got as a graduate student, his own room and access to the archives, are what we all want in an archive.
Exactly.
But yeah.
And he, you know, I knew him very briefly at the end of his life, and he remained as intellectually sharp and as focused, you know, in his 90s as he, I guess he was. I can't have to imagine what he was like, you know, when he was much younger. Really, really a hugely important figure in the historical profession in the 20th century. Right. Your third person still probably before any of my people, right?
Yes.
But to be fair, like, you're starting an earlier period, so I can't pick people from the 1840s because my war hadn't happened yet.
And this is a controversial one. This is one I struggled with, and it relates to my own research interests. So to some extent, not everyone would have this individual on their list, but it is. But I wanted a biographer because biography is an important historical methodology. And anyway, it's Dumas Malone, who is the great, I'm using great advisedly, biographer of Jefferson. So Malone lived from 1892 to 1986, had a good long life, and he's best remembered for his six-volume, 3,000-page biography of Thomas Jefferson. The individual volumes, of course, have their own names, but it's collectively it's known as Jefferson and His Time. The dates for that are 1948 to 1981, so he worked on it for a good long time. Malone is a controversial pick in some ways, and I'll say something about that in a second, but just to give you a kind of brief background, he was born in Coldwater, Mississippi in 1892, raised in Georgia. I can't remember what his father did. I know his mother was a suffragette. So his interesting background. He studied as an undergraduate at Emory and then went to Yale for graduate school in the 20s after serving in the First World War. He was in the military in the Marines in the First World War. Malone then wrote, I mean, he was the editor, if memory serves, of the Dictionary of American Biography. So he had a kind of important role, and quite a public-facing role for a while, because that's a really important reference work. He wrote several biographies of various figures from the early 19th century before taking on writing what was, for its time, the preeminent biography of Jefferson. Now, the reason Malone is a slightly controversial pick is he's got a real blind spot where in his analysis of Jefferson, where race is concerned, where he basically accepts the view that Jefferson was anti-slavery, doesn't have a lot to say about slavery in his 3,000 pages, apart from saying, look, Jefferson was a pretty good guy who treated his slaves well, and he's kind of skates over that. Of course, that is a major theme, if not the major theme, of much Jefferson scholarship of the past 50 years, that is slavery, and Malone kind of just missed that. Along the same and in a related fashion, he completely dismissed Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings, dismissing it as what he called in one appendix the miscegenation legend. And so one can rightly fault Malone's biography for missing this key or these two related elements that are so central to Jefferson's life that might call into question the broader book or books. Our friend Annette Gordon Reed, who's written more about Sally Hemings than anyone else and clearly has a different view than Malone on this, has gone to pains to say, actually, this does not discount the quality of Malone's other work on Jefferson, much of which is very important. To this very day, not a week goes by when I'm writing where I don't consult Malone, because Malone has an encyclopedic approach to Jefferson in his life. It makes the book hard to read, frankly. It's a real struggle because it's a slog, because it, you know, he goes into such detail. And the other thing, there's another reason why I think Malone deserves some credit, which is he didn't have the benefit, you know, of the published editions of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson that modern scholars have. He was writing his early volumes while Julian Boyd, who's the great editor of Jefferson's papers, was editing and producing them. And I have frequently tracked down Malone's footnotes, and he's more often than not right in terms of, you know, he mastered this vast, and I can't tell you how vast it is, this vast corpus of primary sources without the kind of modern aids that we take for granted. And I'm not talking just like web-based things, but even the published volumes. And so his achievement is extraordinary. And again, I've talked to Annette about this. We both kind of acknowledge that Malone is problematic, but also a quite important figure. I almost took Fawn Brody, who's another great biographer of Jefferson, who was in opposition to Malone, and Brody and Malone did not agree. And Brody would have been an easier pick because she's a more sympathetic figure, because she's right on Sally Hemings and everything else. But I think Malone's achievement deserves some recognition. I would also say, you know, this is where people aren't necessarily all good or all bad. It's very easy to stereotype Malone as a sort of somebody born in the – a white man born in the segregation South in the 1890s who came of age in that environment, who had a blind spot where race and slavery were concerned with his main subject. That's all true. There's a letter in Malone's papers where he writes to the NAACP in Charlottesville. He was the Thomas Jefferson Foundation professor of history at UVA for most of his career. And he's writing to the local NAACP in the late 1960s, early 1970s, to ask whether the boycott of the local cinema had ended, because he wanted to take his wife to the movies, but he was honoring the boycott because when – years before the movie theater was segregated. And so we got to be careful. We have to put people in the context of their times, but also people aren't all good or all bad necessarily. And Malone's achievement is really remarkable. His, you know, his fifth volume on Jefferson's second administration is written during Watergate, and Jefferson's second administration is problematic in all kinds of ways. I won't go into the detail. And Jefferson comes off as a little bit Nixonian in that volume. So it's an interesting book. Very few people will read it start to finish because it's a tough slog, but it's an important book and a landmark. And
so you're citing things that are like thousands of pages long, and that's okay.
Yeah, well, anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Well, these are lifetime achievement awards.
Exactly. All right.
I mean, this is where I would say and maybe we'll do this in a future episode if listeners want it. We could talk about our top five books from our field, and I think my list would be very different. But yes, I would say that, yeah, my first three nominees have all written very long books. But anyway, who's your number three?
They all needed a good editor. Right. Yeah. So my doing in chronological order, I guess this is number three, Ann Fearer Scott. So she's born in 1921, you know, and sort of thinking about the sort of world she grew up in, you know, she's born the year after, women got the right to vote. And, and I think, you know, she grew up in a period in which women were not, well accepted in the historical profession. You know, she describes going to conferences in the 1950s where there were you know, you could fit all the entire female attendance at the conference into a small hotel room, and oftentimes the three or four women stayed in the same hotel rooms because that's what they could afford. She's a phenomenally important scholar, probably best known today for a book she wrote in 1970 or published in 1970 called The Southern Lady, From Pedestal to Politics. She wrote a series of other books on women's suffrage, on women's experience in the American South. You know, she's somebody, you know, in some ways like John Hope Franklin, who has to sort of fight against embedded prejudices to be able to teach. She's the first woman to teach history at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm picking a bunch of these that actually have sort of personal connections because of places I've been to. But in 1961, she's asked to teach at Duke. But they only ask her to teach, and this is the language that when she tells the story, she was asked to teach until we can find somebody, which in her mind meant like, we want you to teach until we can find a man to teach instead, because we really want a man instead. But she ends up teaching at Duke for the rest of her career. In 1980, she becomes the chair of the Duke History Department. And so I think she's somebody who has to sort of struggle with a whole series of sort of professional barriers that male historians at the same time period does not. She's deeply involved in politics above and beyond her scholarship. So she's involved in the National League of Women's Voters. Lyndon Johnson appoints her to the Advisory Council on the Status of Women. So she's prominence in that respect. And she's also, and I'm always interested in sort of historian families, she's the mother of Rebecca Scott, who is a very prominent historian now at the University of Michigan, I believe, who wrote a whole bunch of books of great importance, including Degrees of Freedom, Louisiana, and Cuba After Slavery, which won the Frederick Douglass Book Prize. And so as a person who has a child who's in graduate school, I'm always interested in these sort of academic families. So, yeah, Anne Scott is my third choice chronologically. And she died in 2019, so just not that long ago.
Right, okay. Excellent.
Who is your third pick?
I'm finishing with my fourth pick. But I'm finishing
fourth
with two
pick.
People
okay.
who were renowned for being remarkably nice. So I'm pleased about this. So my fourth pick is Edmund Morgan. Edmund Morgan was born in 1916 and died in 2013. He was at Yale for his entire career, or most of his career, from 1955 to 1986. His career is very interesting. So he studied he did his graduate work at Harvard with Perry Miller, the great historian of Puritanism and intellectual history. And early in his career, in the 1940s, Morgan wrote three books on Puritans and Puritans in America in different ways. But then he shifted gears in the 1950s and started writing on the Revolution. And he wrote two landmark books on the Revolution in the 50s. In 1953, with his wife Helen, he wrote The Stamp Act Crisis, which is a really important book in the kind of historiography of the Revolution. It's often seen as a key text in the kind of neo-Whig interpretation, which placed strong emphasis on ideas, and the Stamp Act Crisis is an important book. 3 years later, he wrote a very short book called The Birth of the Republic, which is a one-volume history of the Revolution. It stands the test of time. To this day, it's one of the best one-volume – it's very brief. It's about 130 pages, one-volume history of the American Revolution. It's a really, really fine book. But the reason he's on my list, I think, is for a book he wrote in 1975 – or published in 1975 called American Slavery, American Freedom, which will be known
sure.
to David and to
yeah, it's a wonderful
most of our
book.
Listeners. And it's an incredibly important book. It's a detailed look at colonial Virginia and the emergence of slavery there. Samuel Johnson, the great English lexicographer in 1776, memorably asked, "Why is it we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes?" And Morgan answered that question in a kind of unusual fashion that's kind of really changed the parameters of our discussion about race in America, I think. So Morgan's argument, and it's a complex argument, is, you know, Americans, white Americans, embraced equality and liberty, not despite owning or not despite practicing chattel slavery, but because of it. So in other words, his argument, and I'm simplifying a very complicated and eloquent argument that he makes in the book, is, you know, white Americans could only feel themselves equal to each other because they enslaved Africans. And he explains why that is and the relationship between race and class in early America. It's a really, really fine book. And it was a real, you know, it came out right as Americans were celebrating the bicentennial of the revolution. It was in the aftermath of Watergate and the Vietnam War. It's quite a dark view of America and American history, slightly at odds, or actually not slightly, at odds with his earlier work. So it's quite, it's an interesting, and it's a landmark book that still is read to this day. And can be read profitably. And I never met Morgan, much to my regret, because everybody who did and everybody who worked with him, you know, just said he was an absolutely lovely person and a wonderful man. And so Edmund Morgan is my friend.
I heard this story about Ed Morgan. Sorry.
No, go ahead, Frank. Go ahead.
I just heard this story once about somebody who was studying the Puritans in grad school and was at a cocktail party with a bunch of people who weren't historians, and somebody said, "Oh, you should meet my friend Ed. He's also interested in the Puritans." And they end up talking for like 45 minutes before he realizes who he was talking to, you know, which I think sort of speaks to, you know, he seems like a fun, humble kind of guy, despite, you know, writing a number of really, really important works on some diverse topics. You know, people in Virginia tend not to do New England, right? I mean, even though you think, like, well, that's, you know, all colonial stuff, those tend to be sort of different groups of people. And so he was able to sort of bridge that in interesting ways.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, he had a real – and very late in life, this was the last point I was going to make. He wrote a biography of Benjamin Franklin that was very good. It's excellent. And he – as one can do late in life, and when you're Edmund Morgan, you can do what you want. because what he did is a bit like David Donald's biography of Lincoln. He totally ignored the secondary literature and he based it solely on the primary sources. And it's a very, very interesting, and it's a short biography. It's the opposite of Dumas Malone. It's a very short biography of Franklin, and it's really outstanding. I mean, yeah, Edmund Morgan, very fine historian.
Okay, good.
Who's your number four, David?
Number four. So, you know, since we're doing these in chronological order, my number four is fourth on my list, but actually dies before all the other ones I talked about. So he didn't live as long. And that's Herbert Gutman.
Oh, yeah.
Born in 1928, died in 1985. So, you know, there's a whole body of scholarship, unfortunately, we don't have because of his relatively early demise. You know, he's somebody as a historian who thought very actively about the intersection between contemporary politics and the scholarship that he's doing. And so, you know, I think he's and was very interested in having his scholarship be important not only to other academics, but also, you know, have an impact in the broader world. He's probably bet there's sort of three books he's known for. I think he only wrote three books, maybe. So he's known for all of them. One is The Black Family in Slavery and Freedom, which is a response in many ways to the Moynihan Report from the mid-1960s, which was a government report that postulated that the black family was fractured by slavery and the absence of black fathers. And Gutman writes this book in response in part to that, but also in response to things going on in the scholarship that argues that African-Americans had really robust and strong family ties that were phenomenally important despite all of the pressures put upon them by slavery and the world after slavery. That's still a book that's worth reading, a book that still people need to engage with when they think about African-American families. He wrote a book called Slavery in the Numbers Game, which is a response to Time on the Cross, which is one of the most controversial books on slavery in the 1970s, where he, you know, thinking about a book that sort of systematically takes apart another book, Slavery in the Numbers Game is really a phenomenal, interesting text, and what, sort of a really great one for students to read so they can see how a historian reads another historian. Because we often talk about sort of, you know, how do we teach students how to write historiography and how things respond to something else, and sometimes it's kind of oblique how things are responding to something else. In this case, Slavery in the Numbers Game was sort of written in a sort of fever dream immediately after Time on the Cross was, as a response to it, and sort of rebuts it point for point. So a very interesting and important work. And his final book, Work, Culture, and Society in Industrializing America, which really sort of reframed in many ways how people were doing labor history, especially in the late 19th century, taking the emphasis away from labor unions and organizations to thinking about questions about culture and the ways in which working people of a variety of backgrounds, you know, sort of thought through their place in society. He's somebody who was very involved on the left politically. You know, so when he did labor history, he tried to teach people who were in labor unions about labor history. He taught very often at African American colleges at the very end of his life, because he was interested not only in studying black history, but in, you know, being involved in the African American community and in terms of using his historical knowledge as a tool for empowerment. So Herbert Gutman.
Excellent.
A very interesting scholar with a kind of strange career, but worthy of recognition.
Yes, indeed.
Who's your number? I guess we're up to your number five pick.
Right. My number five, David, is Pauline Maire.
Ah, good choice.
Yeah, thank you. Pauline Maire was born in 1938 in St. Paul, Minnesota. She died in 2013. She too came from the Neo-Whig tradition. She was a student of Bernard Balin's at Harvard, and she taught for many years, mainly at MIT. She's famous really for three different books, From Resistance to Revolution, which she published in 1972. Her dissertation, her PhD dissertation, was on Samuel Adams. She wrote her first book was on Samuel Adams, but the From Resistance to Revolution really helped reconceptualize our attitude towards crowds and riots in the run-up to the revolution, and looking at the ideology of people in popular disturbances. And then late in her career, she wrote two books, American Scripture in 1997, which is about the drafting of the Declaration of Independence, which really is on the short list of the most important books on the Declaration of Independence. There's no question about that in my mind, and I've really come to value that book. And in 2010, she wrote a book called Ratification, which The People Debate the Constitution, which really took a close look at the debate over the ratification of the Constitution in 1787 and 88, and it's a very, very important book. It's an excellent book. She again sought to some extent, it brought her career full circle, because on one hand it looks at the end of the revolution, if you will, with the Constitution and the debate over that. But she was looking again at popular attitudes. She read there's an edited collection called The Documentary History of the Ratification of the Constitution, which is an important resource for historians. But she really mined that to find out what kind of popular views about the Constitution. And so it bookended her career with her earlier work on kind of popular views about the origins of the revolution by looking at popular views about the Constitution, which, you know, can be said to be the end point of the revolution. And so it's a really important career. She wrote, the two latter books, American Scripture and Ratification, really were written with not just a scholarly audience in mind, but also a popular audience. And I think she achieved that. Ratification won the Washington Book Prize, which is basically the prize for the best book on the revolution and early national period in a given year. She won that in 2011. She's also another person who was very, very nice. I did meet her briefly. I mean, she never would have remembered it, but I remember meeting her at a seminar at the Massachusetts Historical Society when I was in graduate school. And this was the Boston area early American seminar. And two scholars were there, both of whom are still alive and both of whom are still active and both of whom are quite eminent today, but they were kind of sharp-elbowed, ambitious young men, and their gender might be important in this story, because they were getting into it as people sometimes do at seminars, especially scholars of that age trying to prove themselves. And it became a bit heated, and Pauline Maier said to one of them, "Oh, you," and she used his name, "settle down." And she said it in such a way that it just sucked all the tension out of the room, because this was, as sometimes will happen with academics, she just said, I'll use your name. She said, "David, settle down." And it was...
I'm glad she didn't have to tell me that. I'm usually pretty settled. But
she said it in such a... it wasn't cutting at all. It was actually quite gentle, and it took all the kind of aggro out of this moment. It was escalating in a way that seminars sometimes do, that's pretty unhelpful and unedifying. And I remember there sitting there as a PhD student thinking, "Ooh, this is interesting." And I've always remembered that about Pauline Maier. It was very, very, it was actually quite a sweet moment. And Pauline Maier is my number five.
I also met her briefly once at a seminar when I was in graduate school, which was sometime after you were in graduate school, but she also struck me as someone who was very, both a brilliant scholar and very, very nice and kind and friendly and stuff.
Yeah, I would agree. So I'm really happy that I Henry Adams and Dumas Malone kind of problematic in certain ways, but I'm happy that I was able to add Edmund Morgan and Pauline Maier to my list for this Hall of Fame, because they were very, very nice people. Who's your number five, David?
So I should just preface this by saying, just again, coming up with five is really hard. And there were a number of really sort of extraordinary people that I had had on my long list that I didn't end up getting into my final five. And my fifth pick is a cheat. I'm picking a couple, Eugene Genovese and Elizabeth Fox Genovese.
Oh, okay.
Well, and
you know what? These are our rules. You can cheat.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's our podcast, so we get to pick the rules. So they were both historians of the American South. Elizabeth Fox Genovese actually began her career as a historian of France, but after their marriage became a Southern historian like her husband. They both wrote a series of books on their own. Eugene Genovese's most well-known for Roll Jordan Roll and the Political Economy of Slavery, which are really sort of foundational texts in the sort of modern study of slavery in the United States. She's best known for a book called Within the Plantation Household that looks at gender and the politics of gender on the plantation. And they also wrote a series of books together. And in some ways, I'm imagining, in fact, that most of their books, even if they only have one author on the title, they really were a intellectual partnership. And in that respect, I think they're in good company. We can think about Charles and Mary Beard, for instance, as sort of a academic power couple. Genovese's, I think, were really important in terms of reframing some of the discussions about paternalism on the plantation, about how the slave economy worked, about sort of they wrote a book trying to get in sort of the mentality of slave owners. Ultimately, I think they're actually both wrong on most of the major questions they're trying to answer, but they ask some really good questions. And I think they're sort of continue to be worth reading in large part because they had a phenomenal role in shaping the field, in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. Personally, they were, my understanding is, and I've met each of them briefly before they passed away. They both began as liberals, and Eugene Genovese at various points described himself as a Marxist, but sort of midway through their lives, they both became conservatives, and she actually became a sort of a role model for lots of conservative women within and outside of academia. At one point, he describes himself as a conservative Marxist. I'm not quite sure what that is. You know, and so they ruffled some feathers at various points in time, both early as being too far on the left, and later in life where they were seen as being too far on the right. But I think they're really sort of the body of scholarship they produce, both individually and collectively, is so important. I think they deserve to be in our little Hall of Fame.
Excellent, I agree.
Now, where are we going to put this Hall of Fame, Frank? If Cooperstown, New York is what's the origin? You know, and Cooperstown doesn't deserve it because the Abner Doubleday story is all fake. But where does this Hall of Fame belong?
Well, there's no question that Boston is the center of the universe and the center of, you know, for a long time you could get away with calling, you know, the history of New England the history of America. So I think we should return to that tradition and put it in Boston. Because I thought we would have more Civil War historians from you, but you really went with Southern historians, I know.
Well, I went with,
So I think we want to induct all these people into the Hall of Fame in Boston, all these Southern historians. I think they...
Oh, yeah, no, I think it has to be in Chapel Hill. Because all these people spend a huge amount of time in the Southern Historical Collection, so, all right, listeners, if you have better picks than ours, and
I'm sure you do. Yeah,
please let us know, because we may have to do this again for the 20th century. Although that's tricky, because most of the prominent 20th century historians are still with us, thankfully.
Well, and thankfully, and we were trying to avoid living historians because that would be particularly invidious. I mean, I have a long list that would be very different if it were living historians. But there we are.
Yeah, I have. I'm just looking back at my list. My list is a list of is all people who died relatively recently. Captain Bean, I guess, the exception. Right.
Yep.
Last drops, what you got?
Yes, I want to endorse something with Halls of Fame in mind. This is kind of keeping with that. I want to endorse a YouTube channel, David.
YouTube channel.
Yes, which is called Classic Baseball on the Radio. And so what this what is made available on this channel is it's basically exactly as the name suggests. So they are radio broadcasts of baseball games from the 1930s onward. And some of them are quite famous games, you know, World Series game sevens and things like that. But others are just regular season games from kind of random teams and random seasons. Given the lockdown and given the fact that the Bundesliga just started last weekend, but there isn't much sport to watch or listen to at the moment anywhere, this is a very good diversion. So if you're a baseball fan and you want to listen to radio broadcasts, then there are hundreds of games available on this YouTube channel. It's a slight frustration for me that it's on YouTube, so you can't download these and listen to them when you're out, you know, walking, for example. So you've got to be on the internet to do it. But it's really, really great. Really great.
I guess sports reruns are I guess a relatively new thing.
The
closest thing to a sport rerun. Go ahead.
No, so I like listening to games I don't know the outcome of, so I've been listening to kind of not famous games as a result. Okay. Anyway, sorry, David.
I was just the thing that reminds me of, there was a back in the 80s and 90s, they used to air the Home Run Derby television program. Do you remember this?
That's right.
Yeah, it's from like the 50s and 60s, but they'd air it. You know, that was the only sort of sports reruns I can remember. And those were stupid because they'd have to interview the players between innings, and it was always sort of like, what are you trying to do? And I tried to hit the ball out of the park.
Right. And
kind of boring, but.
And one thing about then ESPN Classic for a while, I don't even know whether that even still exists, does show kind of classic games, as it were, and sometimes from the recent past, sometimes from the distant past. One good thing about this channel is most of the broadcasts still have the original ads in there. It's really great. You know, if you want to hear who was advertising, I don't know, for the New York Mets in 1963 or 68, you can hear that. It's really good, really good. So if you're missing sports, any of our listeners, I can recommend Classic Baseball on the Radio.
Classic Baseball on the Radio. Okay, great.
What about you, David? What's your last one?
I'm not sure this is an endorsement so much because I'm not quite sure what I think about it yet, but I think it's interesting and worth checking out. And that's Jill Lepore's new podcast, The Last Archive. We've talked about Jill Lepore previously on the show. She's teaches at Harvard and has a column in The New Yorker and seems to write a book every other year, when she's not working very hard. So a phenomenally productive scholar in all kinds of levels, but she now has a podcast because she just wants to, I guess, dominate everything. And the new podcast is called The Last Archive. And I'll just read you the official blurb of it. In The Last Archive, acclaimed historian Jill Lepore traces the history of evidence, proof, and knowledge in troubled epistemological times. Which sounds very strange, and the podcast is kind of strange. It's situated as a true crime podcast, of which there are many, but it's sort of a true crime podcast mixed with historical methodology. And they've had two episodes thus far. The first one involved a murder in Vermont in 1919. The second one episode involved Marston, the guy who invented the lie detector, and Wonder Woman, whom Lepore had previously written a book about. And it's all done in sort of the style of a 1930s radio drama. So half of it's Joe Lepore doing historian talking head thing, and half of it are a group of actors sort of reenacting court cases from decades past, but in the style of a sort of 1930s era noir radio drama, which is kind of strange. And I haven't decided yet whether I like it or not. There seems to be some stuff she's doing under the surface beyond sort of telling these stories about particular crimes and how they unfolded. But I guess we'll have to see. There's only two episodes thus far, and I'm curious to see what she ends up doing with this, because I'm betting there's some sort of something happening under the hood that I'm not fully aware of yet.
Is it a limited run series, David, or is it a new series that's going to be weekly, forevermore?
No, I'm not sure we know yet. So I think the official website says the season one. I guess it's going to be a half dozen episodes or something. But they are releasing this, on a weekly basis. So worth giving a listen to see whether you like it. I'm still not sure yet, but I'm intrigued by it.
Excellent. Good.
Great. Until next week, Frank.
Yep. Cheers, David.
Cheers.
Be well.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.